Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
With all the focus on widening access to health insurance, you might assume that signing up for a policy makes you ready to weather a medical crisis. But if that's all you've done, you may still be at risk for misdiagnosis, medical errors, and substandard care. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. It's not easy to suddenly take on the complicated burden of coordinating healthcare when you or a loved one are dealing with a serious illness. Important things can fall through the cracks, and we can fail to ask what important questions we have or communicate effectively about what we want. The ideal solution, my guest will tell us, is to start learning to manage your healthcare before you get sick. Leslie D. Michelson is founder, chairman, and CEO of Private Health Management. His new book is called The Patient's Playbook, How to Save Your Life and the Lives of Those You Love. Leslie, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much, Chris. It's my privilege.
You know, so much of the book sounds obvious in terms of the advice, and yet, I'll confess, I don't know a lot of healthy people who are ready for a serious illness. We assume when the time comes, the system will sort of navigate itself.
And it's a mistake to think that there is a system out there that will support us in the way we deserve to be supported whenever we get sick. And the data are very disturbing. It turns out that medical error is the third leading cause of death in the United States. We lose 400,000 Americans to preventable medical error each and every year. That's the third leading cause of death behind heart disease and cancer, and is the equivalent of two fully loaded jumbo jets crashing every single day of the year with no survivors. So it becomes imperative for people to learn how to become their own advocates, to learn how to become part of their care team, and learn how to partner with their physicians.
Your passion for helping people become their own advocates or advocates for those they love is tied to personal experiences for you.
Yeah, it started when I was 17 years old. I was in high school. My dad came home one night, visibly nervous, very upset. I'd never seen him that way before. And when I asked him what was wrong, he explained to me that he'd been to the cardiologist that day, who told him he needed open heart surgery. Chris, I didn't know what that was, but it sounded scary, and he was quite fearful. So I couldn't sleep that night. I couldn't function the next day at school. So when I got home, I picked up the phone. We lived in suburban New Jersey. And I dialed Lenox Hill Hospital in New York, the only hospital whose name I knew, asked for the chairman of cardiologist, and set up a consultation for a second opinion. When my dad went 2 weeks later and came home, he told me that the expert cardiologist at Lenox Hill told him there was nothing wrong with his heart, he didn't need the surgery, and the physician who was recommending it should be shot in the public square. Well, my dad didn't have the surgery. He lived 40 more years, never had a heart problem. I got 4 decades, Chris, with my fabulous dad. He got to know my wife. He got to know my 2 precious daughters. It changed my life in so many ways. One phone call.
That speaks to one of the things you write about in the book, which is the fact that over-treatment can be as dangerous as under-treatment.
Yeah, the data show that about 30% of everything we do in medicine is either unnecessary or counterproductive. I tell a story in the patient's playbook of a friend of mine, actually, we called Jim. Lived in Northern California, had shortness of breath one day, couldn't get up the steps, called a cardiologist who he didn't know, scheduled him for an angiogram the next day, and put in 3 stents in his heart. He didn't get any better. In fact, he got worse. And it turned out there was absolutely nothing wrong with his heart. He had a lung problem, and had he had the wisdom to go to a good primary care physician, he probably would have been directed to a pulmonologist who would have been more capable of figuring out what was wrong with him. And now he's got to lead the rest of his life with these stents he didn't need, and he spent 77 days, 11 full weeks in bed on oxygen that was totally unnecessary.
Something that you stressed in the book that surprised me was that except in very rare cases, it's usually not necessary to proceed with a recommended treatment until we've had time to think about it. I think if a cardiologist told me the first time I saw him or her, you need this treatment right away, I would almost be scared into saying, okay, go for it.
Absolutely. And believe me, I am so sensitive to the notion of how vulnerable we feel when we're sick and the incredible respect, justly deserved, that we provide to our physicians. But it's our health at the end of the day. It's our life. And what we all need to do is make sure that we get the diagnosis confirmed and that we understand when and why it needs to be treated. I mean, there are just so many cases like that. Jim's a terrific example. You know, we've had two cases in the past couple of months of patients who were being treated for the wrong cancer. One had been treated for 6 months, and we finally confirmed what the right cancer was. It was too late. And fortunately, the other one, we were able to identify it right after the first chemotherapy treatment, and we were able to shift that patient to the proper intervention. The Institute of Medicine in Washington, D.C., last week, published a report that estimated that on the order of 10% of all deaths in the U.S. every year are the result of diagnostic errors, either the wrong diagnosis, an incomplete diagnosis, or a delayed diagnosis. And, you know, the best way to remember this for me is what the carpenters do. They measure twice and cut once.
Right.
And that's just for a 2x4.
You make a great comparison in the book between shopping for healthcare and buying a new car. And you note that most people wouldn't dream of spending tens of thousands of dollars on a vehicle without checking out safety ratings and mileage and performance data and reading reviews. Sometimes, though, we consent to health procedures without doing anything comparable, or we hire a doctor almost sight unseen.
And it's a mistake. I mean, we all are Americans, are fabulous consumers. And one of the things that's made our economy so dynamic and so active and people able to spend their money in much more productive ways is we all now have more information, as you say. The 82% of the economy that's not healthcare is being energized by more practical and useful information. But the 18% of the GDP that goes into healthcare, it's still tough. But I have to tell you, you and everyone else can begin to tap into what I call the tragic treasure trove of information online. There are dozens and dozens of useful and practical websites that everybody can go to understand their condition, to figure out what the various treatment options are, to know the pros and the cons of them, and to make more informed choices. I can give you a couple of examples. Mm-hmm. If you're diagnosed with cancer, there's a website called nccn.org. It's the National Comprehensive Cancer Network. It's a group of 26 of the preeminent cancer centers in the world who've put together detailed protocols for the treatment of all of the major cancers. And they're intended to be user-friendly, and many of them are in second languages as well. So if you're diagnosed with a cancer, it would take you 5 minutes to understand what the established treatment program is for your cancer. I believe very strongly that if you have a difficult and important condition that might be life-threatening, it might limit what you can do with your life, it's important to get to an expert with the specific expertise in exactly what you have. There's a very user-friendly website called expertscape.com that makes it easy to do that. They've reviewed all of the articles in the medical literature. All you need to do is put in the diagnosis that you've had, locate the city that you're in, indicate how many miles you're prepared to drive, and push search, and it will list for you the hospitals and the physicians who've published the most and therefore done the most research on the exact condition you have. They're likely to know a whole lot more about it.
What about this, Leslie? Many people have had the experience of, you know, finding the person who might appear to be the perfect physician. You call up for an appointment and they say, okay, we have something March 12th and it's now October.
Yeah, that's a tough problem and we're running into it a lot now. There's a variety of techniques that I talk about in the book to break through that. One is to have someone who's important to you call in as well. It feels different on the receiving end if it's a loved one or a friend who's calling in. A second thing is to make friends with who's ever doing the scheduling. Offer to take any cancellation they have, or also to ask them if there's another colleague in their department who has similar expertise. It can be difficult, I understand that, but the reward for getting to someone who's the best at what they do is a lifetime of better health.
You say that the most important relationship we will have with a healthcare provider is the one we form with our primary care doctor. This is the person that most people think of. You know, you go there when you've got a sore throat or your knee hurts, not necessarily for something big, but the relationship can help affect all the other relationships we have going forward.
Yes, the primary care physician, unfortunately, doesn't get the respect that they deserve in the United States of America. Across the rest of the world, the primary care physicians are the gatekeepers. They're the key, and in the U.S., they should be as well. That's the person who should be listening to you, who you should be listening to. It's this person who should make sure you're benefiting from all the latest developments, all the latest developments in early detection and prevention. It's someone who, if your blood pressure is gradually going up, if your cholesterol is increasing, if your weight is increasing, if you're drinking too much, if you're continuing to smoke, if you're not getting the exercise you should be having, that person should be your health partner. They should call you out. They should support you, and they should help you. Because if you make those changes in your lifestyle, it's going to make an enormous difference for the diseases that you'll get 5, 10, 30 years down the pike. And if you should develop a tough diagnosis, that's the person who should get you to the right expert. I tell a story in the book of Stephanie, who had been diagnosed with Lyme disease and had high blood pressure, and they were having a problem keeping it under control. And she changed to a different primary care physician. He listened carefully to everything that had gone on with her. He understood the medications that she was on. And over the period of a couple of weeks, they adjusted her diet, they adjusted her lifestyle, they adjusted her medications, and all of a sudden, everything got back in balance. He made a huge difference for her.
So how do we find the right primary care doctor, and how do we know we've come upon a good fit?
It's a very important question. You know, I relate the process for doing that through a woman in the book we call Haley. It's a three-step process, and you and everyone else can do it. Step one, take out a piece of paper, write the things down that are important to you in a primary care physician. They need to respect you. You need to respect them. The office needs to be organized because there's so much information that bounces around a primary care office. It's someone who, you know, has a good network of specialists and will be active in making sure you're getting to the right people. And it's someone who will support your wellness goals. So the first step is to put down a piece of paper on a piece of paper the things that are important to you. The second step is remember friends, family members, neighbors who have had a positive relationship with their primary care physician. Go back to them. Ask them, who is it? If there's a physician in your life who you like your pediatrician, your OBGYN, or your orthopedist, ask them who they use for primary care. That might be a fit for you. And then lastly, go make appointments and interview them. It's the same thing you would do for interviewing a babysitter, figuring out a lawyer, or someone to renovate the family room. You can do the same thing with a physician to make sure the chemistry is right, because that's such an important relationship.
We're speaking this hour with Leslie D. Michelson, founder, chairman, and CEO of Private Health Management. His new book is called The Patient's Playbook, How to Save Your Life and the Life of Those You Love. Just a reminder, you can tune in today at 2 for the KERA news special Surviving Ebola, which looks back at the virus coming to Dallas a year ago today. If you'd like to be part of our conversation now, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering the SMU Certificate Program, where you can take courses in art, architecture, history, literature, and more. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Leslie D. Michelson, founder, chairman, and CEO of Private Health Management and author of the new book, The Patient's Playbook, How to Save Your Life and the Lives of Those You Love. Join the conversation by emailing think@kera.org or call us. The number is 1-800-933-5372. Leslie, not too long ago, I went back to see a specialist for a minor issue that I'd had 10 years ago. When I got there, I found that my initial x-rays, they hadn't kept them on file. There was no copy, so there was no baseline. It made me wish that I had asked for a copy to begin with so that the doctor could look at both. And you say we should actually ask for our records every time we visit a doctor.
Absolutely. You know, if you travel a lot the way I do and you've got an ATM card in your wallet, you can get $100 in local currency, any place in the country and virtually any place in the world because it's all connected up. But unfortunately, when it comes to medical information, that's not the case. And if you're treated, if you've lived in different towns, if you've been treated by different physicians in different hospital systems, they're not going to have the information they need. And physicians are the only respected professionals in our entire society who are routinely asked to render judgment and provide services on incomplete information. So I encourage you and everyone else to collect your medical records. They're your property. You have a right to them. It's very easy to do. You can just download a form, a HIPAA release form, Google it in 2 seconds, send it to your physician's offices, and they're obligated to give you your medical records, which you should organize in a notebook and maybe digitize them if you're tech savvy, and have them with you all the time. It can be the difference between life and death.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also email think@kera.org. Let's go to J.D. in Dallas. Hello, J.D.
Well, thank you for taking my call. I'll be as brief as I can. I do believe there's 400,000 people lose their lives in the medical industry by the mistakes. There's another number that needs to be tallied, and maybe another. One is people who just are terrified to go to the doctor till it's too late and maybe don't go at all until they pass on. That number, how do we tally that number? And then, of course, myself, I've been traumatized in hospitals twice. I've got post-traumatic stress syndrome from being treated in hospitals, mistakes that are made. So we have those people out here, and people are just will not go to the doctor. I lost my best friend many years ago. His brother had the same medical condition. No problem with him. He went on and got treated. He did not. He would not go to the doctor. He just would not go. He just, or whatever, he just didn't like it, and he passed away.
Well, J.D., I'm really sorry for your loss, but I appreciate your call.
Yeah, I'm so sorry as well. It's terrible to lose a friend, particularly when there may have been an opportunity to do better. And I know there are a lot of people out there for whom the healthcare delivery system is overwhelming and intimidating, and it's difficult to summon the courage to do it. But what I can tell you is if you can rely on friends and loved ones like you and family members to help you find that courage, it can make an enormous difference for you. And physicians generally, once you get in, are much more sensitive than you think they will be to the anxiety that you're experiencing. So I'm so sorry to hear that. It would be great if we had those statistics. I think they'll just be really tough to come by.
When somebody is in a hospital, that patient or the loved ones of that patient really have to keep on top of what's going on in a way that that might take people by surprise. You know, not every person who comes in contact with the patient may be fully aware of their whole history, that sort of thing. What do you suggest, Leslie, to people who might have a loved one in long-term care, so that they can't be with them 24/7, but want to stay on top of how their loved one is being treated and medicated and cared for?
Chris, a very good point. Hospitals are healing places. They save countless lives every day. Assisted living facilities, nursing homes, rehab facilities, they do marvelous work, but they're all dangerous because mistakes get made. So what I do for myself and my loved ones, and what I encourage everyone to do, is always to have a healthcare advocate with you, someone who can make sure that everyone who touches you has washed their hands, someone who can make sure that if there's a change in medication, it's been ordered by the doctors, that every single test that you're having is one that you need and makes sense for you. And when it's time to leave, making sure that you get discharge instructions so you know what medications you should be taking, what things you need to watch for, who to call if something goes wrong, what durable medical equipment you might need to have, what things you should do. Perhaps you should be walking around every hour. And what things you shouldn't be doing, perhaps you shouldn't be walking up steps. And write it down so that you can be safe.
When you talk about asking these what you call courageous questions of our health providers, including like why tests or procedures or medications are necessary, one that I love is this question, what happens if we don't do this? That seems to really crystallize everything we really want to know as patients.
You know, it really does. And we tend to just revere doctors and hold them in such high regard that we don't ask those questions. But doctors do better and really appreciate patients who become partners. So I encourage everybody to learn about their disease online, study it, go to doctors with the exact expertise in what they have, and become partners by asking good and focused questions. So that's a good one. What happens if we don't do it? And there's another really good one. What are the alternatives? What are the pros and cons? Are there other facilities in town that might treat this condition differently? When do we need to do it? There's a case I always think about that always troubles me. It's a financial executive in New York who had terrible back pain, and he just didn't know what to do about it. And he got so frustrated and impatient that one of his physicians was a surgeon who was saying, listen, the only thing that's going to improve this for you is surgery, surgery by me, and surgery now. So he in a moment of weakness, he subjected himself to a surgery that he intuitively knew wasn't the right thing to do. And he's been in unbearable pain for years since that because the surgery didn't address the root cause of his problem and, in fact, just aggravated it.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We'll go back to the phones now. We have Kevin on the line in Hickory Creek. Hello, Kevin.
Hi. Yeah, oh gosh, the importance of a primary care physician. I'll tell you two quick stories. I had a physician who had been practicing, I don't know, about 325 years. He was just fantastic.
I remember him.
I don't want to say his name because I probably, but if you were a Canadian American general physician and you practiced in the Addison, Carrollton area, I don't know, you should be beatified. He was absolutely fantastic. Twice he saved my life. He looked at me for 15 minutes and said, you've got a DBT. You need to go get an ultrasound immediately. And there was another time when I was having a really critical reaction to a medication, and he said, did you need to go to the hospital right away? And he said, I'll write you a note on what they need to do. Absolutely awesome. He was really. Unfortunately, he retired. I have a new physician now. 2 weeks after I'd seen this physician for the first time, I got a call from reception saying they wanted to schedule me coming in for an allergy test. And I took the note, and then I thought about it. I called him back, and I said, you know, I haven't had any history of any allergic problems. And now you're asking for this test. I said, you know, I'm just not going to be able to justify this to my insurance company. And they said, oh, well, no, these are covered under your insurance policy. And I said, no, you don't understand. I can't justify my insurance company being charged for an unnecessary procedure. And she got real quiet and goes, so you don't want to take it? I'm like, no. And I had just a similar thing happen. I'd gotten a regular wellness test, get the whole blood test with all the different results, and one of them, urea protein was up. It was like 2 points over, where it shows in the little wellness chart. And he talked about it. He said, well, depending on how bad this gets, you may want to do other things. I got a call the next day from a nephrologist saying I had been referred to them by this doctor. And there was absolutely no reason for that. I mean, if you're 1 or 2 points over, whatever that broad wellness schedule is, that isn't something that should be treated like that. And
well, what do you think? Thank you so much for your call, Kevin. What do you think about all that, Leslie?
Well, you've experienced both the best and the worst of primary care. And you deserve the best. You had a physician who you trusted for a long period of time who had terrific clinical intuition. That's a real gift. I tell one of the stories in the book of an infant who really was ill. His mom took him to the pediatrician. The pediatrician looked at that infant for 2 seconds and said, "We're going to the hospital and we're going now," because she saw that this baby was not doing well and the baby had bacterial meningitis. Hmm. And had she waited till the afternoon or waited till the next day, that baby probably wouldn't have made it. So having a primary care physician who knows you, who has good clinical intuition and has the courage to say, "You know what? I might be wrong, but I see something that needs immediate treatment and we're going to act on my intuition." That's incredibly valuable. And if you have an instinct that your primary care physician is recommending interventions for you that don't make any sense or counterproductive and aren't justified by your clinical presentation, I think that's an indication to get a different primary care physician, frankly.
We have an email that's somewhat related to that. This is from PD, who says, "How do you interview several primary care physicians when your insurance will not cover all those appointments?" Any thoughts?
Yeah, many primary care physicians will invite you in for an interview, just as lawyers and accountants and interior designers will. And some won't. And in every community, it's a bit different. And if physicians will do that, great. Take them up on that, because it's such an important relationship. But if they won't, and you don't have a primary care physician, here's what I suggest. The next time you've got a cough or a cold, go to one of the physicians who's on your list and use it both to figure out what to do about what's ailing you and freight into that dialogue a discussion about whether that person should be your primary care physician as well, so that you can do it legitimately. It's a properly charged visit to your insurance company, and you can assess whether that's a physician you want to have as your quarterback.
I want to go back to this idea of finding information online. You say that if we're diagnosed with a particular condition, especially one that is serious, it's really in our best interest to learn everything there is to know about it. How receptive are doctors to patients saying, "Hey, I was online the other day, and I think this is what might be wrong with me"?
Yeah, there's a bit of a danger in using Dr. Google and becoming your own physician.
Right.
On the one hand, that can be an extreme problem. And there's also a danger of finding some of the things online that are just baseless and don't have any empirical evidence and, frankly, don't work and are counterproductive. At the same time, it's imperative to become educated in whatever you have, because you'll be a partner with your physician. You'll be a member of the care team. And there are good, legitimate sites that have user-friendly information that they've invested a lot of money in developing for you. So, for example, all of the disease-specific foundations are waiting for you to call, waiting for you to go to the website. The Pancreatic Cancer Action Network, PanCAN, the Prostate Cancer Foundation, Cystic Fibrosis. There are so many terrific philanthropies that have spent a lot of money and invested a lot of time in supporting people who are newly diagnosed with these conditions. They want to help. Give them the opportunity.
Is it pretty obvious to most people who have some degree of, savvy on the internet, which sites are malarkey and which ones can be trusted?
It's important to make that distinction, and one of the keys is who is generating the site. If it's a disease-specific philanthropy that's got some stature, well, that should give you some comfort. If it comes with the imprimatur of the NIH, of the National Comprehensive Cancer Centers, of the Mayo Clinic, Cleveland Clinic, MD Anderson, that should give you some additional comfort. But I would be very cautious about things that seem to be malarkey, because they probably will be.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Next on the line, we have Libby in Weatherford. Hi, Libby.
Hello. How are you doing?
Thank Very well.
You so much. This is a fabulous book. I've been in the medical field for 47 years. I've been a nurse practitioner for 20. I know exactly what you have written about, and I appreciate this book so much, because I do this exact same teaching to all of the families that I work with. One of the things, for instance, I wanted to make a comment on, and I'd like for you to comment on. I work with a lot of elderly people. I do a lot of end-of-life care and that kind of thing. And for some reason, the idea of putting a feeding tube into people comes up. And people who aren't eating appropriately or people who are having problems swallowing at the end of life, which is a normal process that occurs. For some reason, the idea of getting a feeding tube at the end of life happens. And, you know, if you go to the gastroenterology website, it actually talks about feeding tubes in terminal illness is actually contraindicated in people with terminal illness or with aspiration pneumonia and that kind of thing. And with that idea that it's contraindicated by the American Gastroenterology Association, you know, why are we pushing it?
Yeah, it's a Libby, kudos to you for the work that you do in supporting people and helping them get the very best from our healthcare system. I'm sure that there are so many people who are grateful to you. I've done that for 30 years, and I've seen the difference it can make in people. And the issue of feeding tubes at end of life is just one of many issues. You know, it's our destiny. And one of the things that I encourage everybody to do in the patient's playbook is to be very clear as they get older, especially as they get older, with their friends and relatives, with their physicians, about what their personal goals are. What are their objectives? What kinds of interventions would they find acceptable? What kinds of things would they not want to have done with them? Because when a time comes that you can't make the decisions yourself, you're going to be dependent on those people. So it's really important to be clear with them and give them the relief of knowing that they're doing exactly what you would want to do if you could make those decisions yourself.
Leslie D. Michelson is my guest. He's founder, chairman, and CEO of Private Health Management and author of a new book called The Patient's Playbook, How to Save Your Life and the Lives of Those You Love. Join our conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. You can also find me on Twitter. My handle is @ChrisBoydThink.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering the SMU Certificate Program, where you can take courses in art, architecture, history, literature, and more. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Leslie D. Michelson, founder, chairman, and CEO of Private Health Management and author of The Patient's Playbook, How to Save Your Life and the Lives of Those You Love. Join us at 800-933-5372. Leslie, I want to talk about the second opinion. This is something that everybody is sort of, until they have a health crisis, sort of vaguely aware that they ought to seek out in those situations. It's not always easy to know where to go for that or how your doctor will respond to, you know, information, conclusions that may be different than his or hers. Can you give us some guidance about seeking out additional information from a different consulting physician?
Sure. There is nothing more complex than human biology, and there's no realm of human knowledge that's progressing more rapidly than biomedical research. And what those two things together mean is that it's extremely difficult for any single physician to be expert in more than one or two things that are very complicated in medicine. And that's why it's important to get not just a second opinion when you've got a tough diagnosis, but an expert opinion from someone who is steeped deeply in exactly what it is that you have. The first story I tell in the patient's playbook is of Catherine, who was diagnosed with a fatal condition called Churg-Strauss syndrome, a devastating diagnosis, and she'd been treated for it for a number of years with a whole lot of medications, and frankly, she wasn't doing very well. She hadn't been treated, however, hadn't been referred to, hadn't consulted with an expert in that condition, Churg-Strauss. So we went online, we found the preeminent expert in the world on Churg-Strauss syndrome, And it turned out she didn't have Churg-Strauss syndrome at all.
Hmm.
All of the symptoms that she had, many of them, were the result of a lot of medications that she was on for a condition she didn't have. It's just one of many examples. And people get nervous that they might alienate their physician. They might offend their doctor by asking for a second opinion. But as you'll see in the book, we quote a lot of physicians who say, you know, it's a good idea to get a second opinion. Like you, I'm fallible. I don't know everything. And if we can find someone who has a better approach to what you have, I'm all in.
And of course, sometimes a second opinion may simply give you confidence that your original doctor was on the right track.
Absolutely. One of the internists, Brian Arling, in the book says, you know, I encourage my patients to get second opinions because one of two things will happen. The second opinion physician will agree, at which point I'm a winner, or he'll find something better, at which point I will learn more and I'll be a better physician. So there's no downside.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone once again, this time to Adrian in Dallas. Hello, Adrian.
Hello. I just wanted to say I'm a physician, and I've been in the position of being a provider and a patient. And I feel that the way that the question is asked is important because there's a risk that providers could become defensive if they interpret the question as communicating a lack of trust or credibility. So I just wanted you to comment on that.
Well, hang on a second, Adrian. How would you like to be approached by a patient who has a question, who wants to challenge whether they need something? How would you say it?
I like the idea of what would happen if I did not do this procedure or take this test. I like that as an idea. I also I like asking questions, but I think sometimes people tend to bring information that's misinterpreted or say, I don't like that, and I think that it's just the inquisition and the spirit of inquisition and wanting to know rather than, you know, bristling at anything that the physician is saying.
Thanks for your call. What do you think about that, Leslie?
You know, let me see if I can model an approach to it because I've asked this question of physicians countless times, and I think there's a way to do it that really works. And I think it starts with, you know, Dr. Smith, I am so grateful for what you've been doing for me, and I appreciate that this is a difficult diagnosis, and I respect the recommendation you're making. But I have to tell you, I'm nervous. I'm scared. I'm not quite sure what to do here. It would make me feel a whole lot better if I could get your support for just seeing another physician who just might have a different perspective on it, because that would just make it a lot easier for me to go forward under these circumstances. So if you speak honestly from the heart, remember, physicians generally go into medicine because of the satisfaction they get from forging strong bonds with patients. And when you handle it right, you will strengthen, not weaken, that sense of bond with your physician.
Sometimes, Leslie, there are people who are fortunate enough to go years or even decades without a serious health problem. Maybe they have a primary care doc, but maybe they only see that person every year or two for just a physical. Is there a good way to create a relationship with someone that you see so rarely?
Sure. You can do that even if you see the doctor infrequently. Because if you do see them with a certain frequency, say once a year if you're, you know, a younger person who's healthy, that physician will still know that you're there, and then you can call them if a day comes when you've got a terrible flu, you've sprained your ankle, you've got a rash that you can't figure out. They'll be there for you. And the important thing is to just have an open line of communication so that you're speaking to them with total honesty and total candor, and you're listening to them and following the advice that they're giving you.
800-933-5372 is our number. We have Lindsay on the line in Midlothian. Hi, Lindsay.
Hi. Long-time listener and fan.
Welcome.
I had a comment and question. First of all, when I was very young, I was about 22, and I was pregnant with my first child with no complications. I went to my doctor, and I do think it's important to add that I was a Medicaid patient in a high-volume office. And I, at my last appointment, was told that I was going to need a C-section because my baby was too big, and they measured him by ultrasound and told me that he was too big. And so they scheduled a C-section, never let me labor or anything. And come to find out, he was actually half a pound smaller than they told me. And so because of that C-section, I had two subsequent C-sections and then was finally allowed to try for a VBAC, a vaginal birth after C-section, after, you know, for my fourth baby, which didn't work out for other reasons. But my question is, can you speak to the over-interventions that are commonly occurring within the obstetric field?
Yeah, that's a very good question, and I'm sorry that you know, you have a sense that you got a procedure that you perhaps didn't need. The whole obstetrics community has been working very hard on developing appropriate guidelines for C-sections. It was a bigger problem years ago. I think the obstetricians and the cardiologists and so many other medical specialists now are stepping up to the plate, convening conferences, developing specific guidelines, publishing studies, and trying to get the problem under control. But even if they do, that doesn't diminish by one iota the importance of you and everyone else learning how to become an effective consumer. And if you feel that, you know, you had an unnecessary procedure and it was known at the time, you should seriously think about changing providers to a physician who you don't believe is going to do that to you.
Let's take an email here. This one's from Janet, who asks, please address the problems that parents of children with rare and orphan diseases face when dealing with doctors who either claim they know all about a disease that is not in their specialty area or refuse to refer patients to the few specialists in the country with expertise.
Boy, that's a very important issue, because the people who have rare and very complex conditions find it all the more difficult to get the kind of care and attention and guidance that they need. But for virtually every disease, there's a disease-specific foundation. And those people are there waiting to help you. You know, the story we told in the book I mentioned earlier of Churg-Strauss syndrome. Churg-Strauss is a very, very rare condition. But there's an association that has a medical advisory board of experts who've dedicated their careers to doing research on that condition, figuring out better ways to diagnose it, and more safe and effective ways to treat it. And that's true for virtually every other condition. And if your primary care physician is not prepared to make a referral, doesn't have the resources to do the research, you've got to do it yourself. Fortunately, one of the things the internet has given us is this fabulous gift of the information is out there. You just need to summon the courage and develop the competence to use it.
At what point do we need to hop from our primary care physician to a specialist? I think about a chronic condition like diabetes that probably a lot of primary care physicians see a great deal of. When should somebody with something like diabetes look for someone in addition to their primary care physician?
So if someone has a chronic condition like diabetes, asthma, heart disease, an autoimmune condition, in my view, it's extremely important to have a specialist with expertise in that precise condition involved. A story in the book of a woman we call Jennifer had a relationship with a primary care physician. She went to him a lot because she had aches and pains in a lot of her joints. She was fatigued. Things were not going well for her. Well, it turned out that she had an autoimmune condition called psoriatic arthritis. And she hadn't been referred to a rheumatologist to diagnose that. Had the primary care physician involved a proper rheumatologist with the requisite expertise years earlier, she could have avoided 5 to 10 years of pain and irreversible damage to her joints. So it's really important to do that. And for the common chronic conditions, there are experts in every major city in the country and terrific ones in Dallas, Texas.
Should we expect our primary care physicians to at least inquire as to the state of our mental health when we go in for a checkup?
This whole notion that there's a dichotomy between mental health and physical health collapses under any scrutiny. Mental health is an integral part of your overall health and well-being. Patients who are depressed experience pain differently. Patients who have pain from a bad back or a broken leg tend to become depressed, become anxious, are subjecting themselves to more stress. So they're both parts of who you are, and there's no reason why a quality primary care physician shouldn't be as attentive to your mental health as they are to your physical health.
Have you been surprised at the way that the Affordable Care Act has changed access to care? I know that a lot of your direct clients are people who have resources to sort of pay for whatever care they want, but the rest of America is relying on the health insurance they get from work or that they buy from exchanges.
And it's a great thing that more people have health insurance. But the next front is, now that there's been some improvement in the health insurance marketplace, is to bring about improvement in the health care marketplace, of getting patients more information about the quality of the physicians they have, more information about the disease they've been diagnosed with, better choices from the array of options about the treatments, the pros and the cons. So I don't think it's about the Affordable Care Act. It's about patients learning to activate their consumerism, their consumer instincts, when they're in patient mode, as opposed to when they're buying cell phones, buying cars, selecting schools, or planning vacations.
A lot of smartphones now are starting to offer like a little app that allows you to store a lot of your health information there. You've mentioned maybe carrying around something like a thumb drive. Do the potential benefits outweigh the potential risks of having your personal information compromised?
You know, that's always a risk. Every single digital record that we have today is subject to compromise. We all know that. But I believe it's really important to have on you at all times information about who you are, who to call in the event of an emergency, the chronic diseases you have, the medications you're on, your blood type, the allergies you have, and other critical information, because you don't know when you're going to need it. I was going to a meeting the other day in the morning, just in a taxi cab, with her second in line in a light, and it's 8 o'clock in the morning, and a car cut a right turn in front of us and hit a pedestrian walking in the walkway.
Oh.
She was clearly on her way to work, and I'm sure she had no idea that she was going to end up unconscious and in an emergency room in 15 minutes. And I wondered whether she had the information she needed. But we shouldn't have to worry about that. It takes 10 to 15 minutes to put it on a card in your wallet. So if that fateful day comes, you're going to have at least that information available to you.
Leslie D. Michelson is founder, chairman, and CEO of Private Health Management. His new book is called The Patient's Playbook: How to Save Your Life and the Lives of Those You Love. Leslie, it's been a really interesting conversation. Thank you for making this time for us.
Thank you so much, Chris.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer with help on the phones today from Braylon Becton. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. I'm on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. The show's email address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.